Okay, let's begin.
You'll note the title of today's shiur, Separating Siamese Twins, an Ethical and a Halachic Dilemma for the Modern Age. And boy, is it ever. Now let me be specific about what I mean in general, and then be more specific, and then be specific about what I mean specifically. What I mean to say is as follows. In halachic literature, as rare or as perhaps even surprising as it may sound, in halachic literature, you will find material about all sorts of things which we will not speak about that relate to conjoined twins, which is the technical term, conjoined twins. I saw somebody recently give a shiur, co-joined twins. The Mechilas Kvodo, I don't think that's correct. I think it's conjoined twins. Yehei Masha, Yehei, whatever it is. But you have literature on, for example, I was joking before, but I wasn't joking, tefillin. Both people need tefillin or one, which is really part of the larger question, which is, are we talking about two people or one? How do you determine that? So that is a very interesting question, which will relate to what I'm going to discuss today. But I want to discuss what's the dilemma. You know, how many tefillin shalrosh you need or something. That's not a dilemma, that's a shaila. What's the moral or ethical dilemma? So that I want to speak about something, not only specifically hypothetically, but specifically lamaisa. And I want to use a very real case to look back and then hopefully look forward of something that actually occurred almost 40 years ago. Almost 40 years ago, hard to believe, but almost 40 years ago. No, what am I saying? A little bit more than 40 years ago. A little bit over, almost 45 years ago. In the United States. This is a real life case, which was, I wouldn't say it's a one in a million, more or less, but as it so happens, I think without question, the most celebrated and controversial case, certainly in recent American history, happened to a Frum family. Out of a few hundred million Americans, it happened to a Frum family. The story is as follows. This is a very, very true story. It occurred in the fall, September of 1977, when a Kollel Avreich in Lakewood, now that could be one of 8,000 people, but Lakewood in those days was maybe 1,000 people, maybe. So, I said almost 45.
Less than 40.
Yes.
Almost
35. Yes. Should have said a number. Good thing. They had twin girls born to them. Mazel tov. Only problem was that the twin girls were conjoined. They were attached. They were what we call Siamese twins. Now, you can be, you've seen it, whether it's, you know, in the movies or in literature, you could be attached at the hip, relatively benign. You could be attached sometimes at the head, which is obviously much more serious. And in their particular case, they were attached at the chest. And they weren't just attached by some kind of a fleshy skin at the chest, but once they did the tests, they found that in addition to other things which were important and intertwined, most importantly was that they shared a heart.
They had one and a half
hearts. The heart that they shared was actually, it seemed like a six-chamber heart. Basically was a full heart, but attached to it, one unit was an extra two chambers, one of which was more in, anyway. This family, Lakewood has, I'm sure, very fine hospitals, but you can't just go to your average hospital for something like this. The family and the babies were immediately flown to one of the most prestigious children's hospitals in the world, certainly the United States, known as CHOP, which is the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where that's what it's called. If you ask anybody in the medical profession about CHOP, they'll know exactly what you're talking about. The head of surgery at that time in the hospital was none other than C. Everett Koop, who just a few years later became nationally famous when Ronald Reagan made him the Surgeon General and he went to war on cigarettes and other things which everyone knew his name from. He was, I don't think anyone has a specialty in Siamese twins, it's too rare, but he was the head of surgery in the hospital and he was the main person in charge of this. After a short while, after they did all the tests, et cetera, the doctors presented to the family the bad news that the only way these children could live was if they were separated. I'm not talking now about quality of life. I'm talking about actual love. There was no way. The heart was not strong enough to support two otherwise fully functioning human beings. I say, if you don't do the surgery, they will both, neither will live. If you don't do the surgery, they will both die. That was bad news number one. Bad news number two was that one of the babies, we'll call this baby B, would die anyway. Even with a successful surgery, there were too many problems anyway, too many other things that were unfortunately malformed in baby B. She would die no matter what. If you keep them together, she'll die. If you separate them, she'll die. Baby A had a chance. I don't know if they gave odds. It weren't great odds. But if baby B, if they stayed separate, connected, both would die. If they would separate, and it could be successful, halavai, halavai, maybe, kulei hai v'ulai, maybe we do have a chance to save baby A. And obviously, from a medical perspective, that was pretty much the only option the family had. Now, medically, this was incredibly complicated, unprecedented. Over 20 specialists in every possible field were gathered in the hospital because they could anticipate, seven specialties that were necessary. But any one of 1,000 things could happen in the surgery, so they had to have all sorts of people on backup, on call, just in case. And of course, each person who was brought in was the top of his or her field in all the 20 fields. And there was who knows how many support staff and nurses, etc., all on call, waiting to see if this was going to happen. Now, while this was going on, before they got to anything that relates to halacha or the parents, the doctors in the hospital had their own dilemma. Some of them, like Dr. Cooper, are actually very religious Christians, and even if you're not a very religious anything, clearly this is not a simple thing, because whatever sanitized medical term you want to use, in essence what they were suggesting medically was to kill baby B to hopefully have a chance to save baby A. That is not something that anyone takes lightly, and that's not something you do every day. In fact, Dr. Koop was so worried himself that he would be prosecuted for murder if they went through with this, he had the lead lawyer of the hospital file a brief to get an approval ahead of time from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Coincidentally, who was the lead attorney for the hospital at the time? Somebody who then went on for many years to be the senator from Pennsylvania? Arlen Specter, a Jewish lawyer who just recently was defeated, but he had a 30-year career in the Senate. So he had a lot of famous people, incidentally, involved in this story. Sure enough, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court gave the heter, in our language, to Dr. Koop. But then he went to all of his doctors and nurses, and he told them, listen, this is a complicated thing. Usually in medicine, if something is considered medically ethical or sound, the average doctor or nurse doesn't always get to vote with their conscience. I know this from relatives or friends who had to do rotations and were forced to be involved in abortions or pulling the plug, and it's not a simple thing. But this was so out of the ordinary that ahead of time, Dr. Koop gave a waiver. Any medical staff that felt that from their religious perspective they could not participate in the surgery would be given a patur in our language. And in fact, if I believe two or three nurses in the end, after speaking with their priests or whatever, actually did beg off. In the meantime, of course, they're waiting. The question ultimately goes to the parents. Do you give permission for us to do this surgery? So basically, the family didn't know what to do. I'm not sure which rabbi the family initially consulted with, your local Orthodox rabbi, but needless to say, very quickly, everyone involved understood that this was not something, with all due respect, for your typical rabbi, and it was agreed that they would bring the shaila to Rav Moshe Feinstein. And Rav Moshe Feinstein ended up spending weeks, not days, not hours, weeks on this before deciding. Now, at the time, he was given the luxury of spending weeks because the babies were stable. So this gave him time, along with his grandson who lives here, Rabbi Shabtai Rappaport, who was involved, Rav Tendler, his son-in-law, who also was a PhD in biology. They were doing the medical research, halachic research. You can't just open up an art scroll book and find the answer to this question. This is quite unprecedented. So they were in the process of gathering research when, about a month or almost a month later, an ICU nurse noticed that the heart rate had declined, and that all of a sudden now it became not inevitable, but could be a matter of days or weeks. They didn't know, but they really felt they couldn't wait much longer. So that was related to Rav Feinstein as well. And then on October 6th, 3 days after that ICU nurse made that discovery, on behalf of Rav Moshe Feinstein, they made the phone call, Matan permitting the surgery. 5 days later, on October 11th, On October 11th, 5 days later, the surgery took place. The one baby was sacrificed, and baby B did survive the surgery. The other, one baby was, life ended on the table. The other baby did survive the surgery. From a surgical perspective, even though it was like, you know, unprecedented and amazing, The surgery was a success. The baby did survive the surgery. All of this, again, took place leading between September and October. What is striking about this particular story, and this is where our shiur comes in, is that for whatever reason, despite the thousands of tshuvas that Rav Moshe Feinstein has written on incredibly controversial and contemplated topics, Rav Moshe Feinstein never, ever, ever published the rationale for his ruling. And, as you can imagine, despite his stature, it was not universally necessarily accepted. This is not a simple thing. I saw in an article, I don't know how, and I didn't, how I would even if I wanted to confirm this, but there is a published article where someone in Tradition magazine years later quoted that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky disagreed with this psak. He felt it was murder. Felt that there would be no heter for it. And here in Eretz Yisrael, the then Rosh Yeshiva and Panovich of Pravarsky has a whole piece in one of his published svarim where he had heard rumors about what Rav Moshe Feinstein's rationale must have been, and he rejected them. He then tries to offer his own rationale. But the point is, you have a combination, which is very rare in halacha, where you have something that's so sensitive and so complicated, and yet you don't even have a written record to really evaluate. So what I would like to do for today's shiur is share with you shtayim shehem shlosha, two, which are really three, really I could say three different rationales, halachic models, that had been proposed, starting with the assumption that Rav Moshe Feinstein is correct, that the surgery was successful. Please let me, I promise you, okay? Everyone in due time. I want to spend the shiur sharing with you three models that have been suggested retrospectively, to look back, to suggest perhaps what Rav Moshe Feinstein might have used as a rationale. We have some bits of information because we have part of it comes from family members who were involved. But ultimately, if Rav Moshe Feinstein didn't put it in paper, we can't be 100% certain. But these are three different possibilities, three different models which might suggest how we could halakhically defend and rationalize what would seem to be on its face something which should be inexplicable and undefensible, which is the halachic permission given to murder a little child. So, of course, the tension here is sacrificing one for saving another. But, as I will show you in a moment, this particular circumstances are pretty unique. But the notion of sacrificing somebody
to, but you don't know when. But
one is really yeah. Yeah, life is life. But we will discuss everything if you let me. Yeah.
If this child didn't die, the other one would have died.
Correct.
Is there something with a mother who's giving birth?
Yeah, we're going to discuss it all, I hope. Yes, we will discuss. Okay? So this is the story. What interests us as halachists is what happened to rationalize the decision that took place on that October 11th with the surgery. Where could you get to do such a thing? Obviously, at first blush, it's a very, very difficult psak. So where would Rav Moshe Feinstein have been coming from? So as I mentioned, while the unique circumstances are such, the concept of a tension between some people and others is certainly not unprecedented in halacha, and I want to start looking at the first model. Okay, if you take a look at your source sheet, source number one, again, there is no identical case. Then everything would have been easy if there was an identical actual case. But we're looking for approximate models that are in halacha, which we can use to look backwards to then help us look forwards. So if you take a look in source number one, it's a statement, a well-known story slash halachic dilemma from the Talmud Yerushalmi in Masechta Trumos. And the Gemara here is speaking about a situation in which you have people traveling who are then surrounded, or you have a city which is then sieged, a Jewish city or Jewish population which is besieged one way or another by non-Jewish bandits. And they, in essence, threaten to kill everyone unless the Jews will submit on their own, one to be the karban, if you will, to be the sacrifice for everybody else. So are you allowed to do that? Now, again, here, getting to a question you asked me a few moments ago, think about it. Again, if we do nothing, if we don't give them one, everyone's going to die anyway, like the baby who's going to die anyway. Our only play here, if we're going to do anything, is to at least save everybody else. So the question is, are we allowed to do that, though? Are we allowed to do that? So the Gemara says in the second line, "Afilu kula neharagin lo yimsru nefesh achas mi Yisrael." It's a very important halacha, which is not just a halacha, clearly there's a philosophy, there's a hashkafa behind this, about the sanctity of every human life, and that is that even if everyone will go down, we will not give over one person. You tell us as a group here. I have a group. Again, I have somebody banging on the door. I'm going to slam this door shut. I'm not letting the terrorists get in. But the terrorist, you know, bangs on the wall and tells me, if I give one lady up, we have 25, 30 women. If I give one of you away, the rest of us will say, and if not.
No problem.
And if not, well, I says the Gemara, there's no way we can choose.
Is he asking you for a specific person?
No, I didn't say. Everyone have to listen. We're going to get to that in a second.
So it's just
the Gemara person. Said, I gave you the example exactly in the Gemara. They said, give us one, and then we'll kill everybody else. Everyone has to die. Everyone. However, says the Gemara, no. We do not give. No, Rabbi Kiva was not talking. Rabbi Kiva was not talking about that case. We're going to get to Rabbi Kiva perhaps later, but this is we are not allowed. Says the Gemara, middle of that line, Yichdu lahen echad, Yigon Sheva ben Bichri. Let's say they ask for a specific person. Now, this isn't just because rabbis who spend all day in Beis Medrash have wild imaginations and eventually think of something, although sometimes we do. But here we have a model in Tanakh. The raya that once upon a time even men learned Tanakh. Because the rabbis in the Gemara, they knew Tanakh. Somehow that fell off the wagon of yeshivas at some point in history. But they said there's a model. It's called Sheva ben Bichri. What happened? He blasphemed against David HaMelech. He was rebelled against the king. He ran away. He went and tried to take refuge within some group. And the general, on behalf of David, runs around trying to find him. And Yoav, basically, I'm not here to discuss the ethics of Yoav's behavior, but Yoav basically threatens the city and says, give us Sheva ben Bichri, and we'll do what we need to do with him, or else we're going to kill everybody. You're harboring, a traitor. You're harboring a traitor. And he was given over. So says the Gemara, what about that case? So says the Gemara, case Yimsuru, third line, Oso Va'al Yehergu. In that case, you are allowed to give him over, and that way everyone has. However, before you get too comfortable, the Gemara says we need to clarify what happened. That's a model in Tanakh, we're endorsing it. But we need to understand better, if we're going to learn how to apply that model, we need to analyze it even more carefully. And this leads to a very important and far-ranging machlokes between Reb Shimon ben Lakish and Reb Yochanan. What can we learn? What exactly is that second case? So the first opinion, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, is Hu sheyehei chayiv misa keshavim v'chri. It wasn't some random person who was chosen. It wasn't some tzadikal, some perfect Beis Yaakov madel. It was a guy who was chayiv misa, was a traitor. Anyway, a Beit Din would have given him a death. It wasn't like anyone was taking some sacrificing some innocent person. So if you'll be in some other situation in which the person who the goyim are after anyway really, really deserves to die, so we're not crossing some ethical Rubicon by giving him over. He deserves to die anyway. The whole, everyone else, 100 people, 1,000 people, 10,000 people, it could be a baseball stadium, 50,000 people, they should all die because of this person who anyway deserves to die. Says Rabbi Reish Lakish, that is what you learn from the Gemara, but that's all you learn. Therefore, if it would be the case knocking on the door here, I assume, I only know you so well, but I'm assuming that no one here is Chayiv Misa for anything. So even if they said, I want you, or I want you, or I want you, but if the you who they wanted wasn't Chayiv Misa, then we'd all have to go down. That's Reish Lakish's opinion. Yes, there is a, quote, heter. Again, I hate to use the word heter when we're talking about sacrificing a person's life, but there's a heter to give someone over, but only if two conditions are met, says Reish Lakish. A, they are identified, and B, they're actually deserving of the fate. Now, if you could have that one in a million case, that's the model of the Tanakh, and that, says Reish Lakish, allows you. But short of that, we are not masil anybody from Klal Yisrael on the cheshbon of somebody else. Good question. It's not discussed in the Gemara, but it's an excellent, excellent question. Could you volunteer? Next opinion comes Rabbi Yochanan. Af al pi she'eino chayiv misa kesheva ben Bichri. Says Rabbi Yochanan, I look at the same story in Tanakh. I'm aware that Sheva ben Bichri was chayiv misa. Why else was Yoav running after him? But in Rabbi Yochanan's halachic opinion, that's irrelevant. That's incidental. The main thing that has to be crossed, the main ethical gap that has to be filled in, is that they picked, because you can't pick. We don't get to pick. We don't get to play God. If this guy already decided to play God himself, so I hate to put it crassly, we're off the hook. But this is a tzaddik. A tzaddikus doesn't deserve death. Tzaddik varela is the first injustice you've seen. That's the time that we'll have on the Rabbanu Shalom one day. We don't understand why. But the person's a tzaddik, they don't deserve it. But again, in all things being equal, if they just said, here, give us that person, we'd say, get out of here. But when it's not just, give us that person, it's, or we'll kill all of you. So Rabbi Yochanan says, the fact that they took the decision out of our hands, that's enough to allow us to go through, as lamentable as it is, with their decision. So here you have a certain sense it's very narrow, but I would say very fundamental machloket between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. What circumstances have to present themselves in order for us to do what is otherwise, and I can't stress this enough, what is otherwise an unthinkable thing for a Jew to do, and that is to save anyone's life on the cheshbon of somebody else. That's the first statement of the Gemara, which we can never forget. Al yimsru nefesh achas miYisrael. We don't do this, even though other people who are innocent could go down. So yet, in stage two of the Gemara, there is a leniency. What conditions have to be met? Reish Lakish is more demanding, if you will. Reish Lakish says, I guess we can't learn. Reish Lakish says you have to have two stipulations. Thank you. Two stipulations have to be met. Number one is the person has to be specified. And number two is that the person has to be deserving of death.
Who decides?
Good question. All good questions.
Do you have to believe it's early, let everybody else live?
I would say obviously. If you think it's all a ruse, then there's no point.
No, because
it's kind of like dealing with certain terrorist partners, you know.
No, but maybe
if you just give us this, we promise we'll stop bombing you. No, so if you believe them, then it's what to talk about. If you don't even believe them, then there's nothing to talk about.
No, but what if, like, you believe that they'll ask for, like, that ended up asking for 15 people, but like the late, like,
I don't know.
The other 20.
I don't know. 5,000. But obviously the assumption of the Gemara is that this would work. If you're doubtful that it's going to work, then that's a whole other thing. So Rav Yochanan says, right, we spent, oh, excuse me, not, we're going to do Reish Lakish first. Reish Lamed, Reish Lakish. So Reish Lakish says you need two things, right? Specified and deserving of death. Rav Yochanan said one is enough. Rav Yochanan said as long as it's specified, you say who you want, then even if the person wasn't deserving of death, just the fact that they were specified. And again, you could see, in terms of philosophically almost, two clearly, I'd say, different point values are animating them. Rav Yochanan, I think, was easier, as I said before. His point clearly is, we don't decide. Ordinarily, HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides. But in this case, once someone else decided to play God, we're not happy about it, but when the alternative is letting a larger group die, we let them go on with that and we could do that. We didn't, as long as we don't decide. That's clearly what's bothering Rabbi Yochanan. Reish Lakish is clearly bothered by something else. Who deserves fairness? How could you have a person who doesn't deserve to die? How could you be involved in they'll die anyway when they burn the whole house down? Okay, but that wasn't your decision. But we don't give over people who don't deserve to die. So once you have someone who's deserving of death, so that is clearly the Rubicon that has to be crossed for Reish Lakish. Again, very, again, hopefully rare, but very fascinating and fundamental machlokes between the two of them.
Stories, things like that.
Yes, so somebody recently told me, I think it was over Shavuos maybe, that there was I'm sure it happened for real, but someone mentioned to me a particular one of the famous Holocaust movies, you know. Okay, but I don't know if it was that one, I think it was another one, but also when there were certain prisoners, someone tried to escape, this is what they did, someone tried to escape, and basically they went to the barracks of 100 people, said, you decide, give us 20 or we're going to kill all of you. I think that was the story that somebody told me. You know, unfortunately in Jewish history, fiction and non-fiction are completely blurred because we have had a history, both the highs and the lows are so unbelievable that it could easily have been fiction. It's just unfortunately real life non-fiction that we've lived. So yeah, every nightmare that some Hollywood screenwriter could imagine, we've already lived. That's unfortunately the case. Take a look at the next source. Number 3 is Rashi. Rashi adds something. It's not clear that, I take that back. Let's leave Rashi for a second, I'm sorry. Go to number 2, the Rambam. So, you know, the million-dollar question, of course, is, how do we paskin? You know, it's a big machlokas. I hope I made that clear, but how do we hold? So, look at where it's underlined in the Rambam. Im hayim chuyav misa kesheva ben bichri, yitnu oso lehem. Im eno chayav misa, yihargu kulon. So Rav Rambam holds like? Rav Rambam holds like Reish Lakish. Which again, for lack of a better word, is a big chumrah. Meaning you have an extra hurdle to overcome before you would permit anything to happen. Now let's take a look for a moment, just to see one thing at Rashi here. Rashi number 3 adds another dimension. It's not clear if everyone else agrees with it, but Rashi adds something which may be very relevant. Rashi says, you know why this is permitted, even in the case where it is permitted? Why was it permitted in the case of the Tanakh? Look at number 3 where it's underlined. Mishum da'afilu lo masruhu lo hayenerag be'ir kshivasana Yoav v'heinerag en imo. Because as we said before, if they didn't give him over, Yoav was not bluffing. He was going to kill everybody. But as Rashi, something which we may not have thought of, although if you have a really vivid imagination, maybe you did, im haya nitzol afal pishahein neragin, lahaya rishalan lamosro, kidei lahatzilo atzmo. It would be a very cruel irony. But says Rashi, what about escape? Maybe while the people are negotiating with Yoav, maybe Sheva Mechri could have slid out the back. Then they would have said, we don't know where he is, and Yoav might have said, okay, I don't believe you, and let's set fire to the whole place. In that case, if he could have escaped, even though he was Chayav Misa, says Rashi, then everyone holds you can't give him over. Because then, by you giving him over, in essence, you've made the choice. But in that case, that wasn't possible. Yoav was a crackerjack general. He had surrounded, there was no escape. There was no escape. So Rashi just adds, again, leave aside the drama of the escape, But the salient point that emerges from Rashi, which we were assuming, but Rashi really underlines and highlights, is it has to be that there's no hope for the person who is designated and guilty. If there's any hope for that person, even if it's minimal, what are the odds of an escape? You know, pick Auschwitz or Alcatraz. What are the odds of a successful escape? Very minimal. But if there's a chance, then even though we have specified and deserving of death, and this is not in the Gemara, it's kind of just left unsaid or assumed, but Rashi makes it explicit and very strong. If there's any chance that the person could survive, then we don't get involved, even though we're putting ourselves at risk, theoretically, like in the case of Yoav. But it's once they assume that the person has no hope, again, Sheva ben Bichri, his fate was sealed the second Yoav found where he was hiding. Either he was going to die alone, or he was going to die with everybody. But Sheva ben Bichri was not saying Moda'ani the next day. His time had come. And Rashi wants you to know that that's really, really important. There was no chance. Then there's a machlokes. Okay, did he specify? But if there's any possibility that he could have escaped, according to Rashi, then everyone would have agreed. You go back to the first din, you can't give him over. Now, the Rambam doesn't mention this. No one else mentions it but Rashi. Do they agree? Do they disagree? It's hard to know. But it's just something to keep in mind when we get to whether it's the Siamese twins case or other cases. You know, when the doctor says, no hope, what do they mean by that? There's a chance, you know, there's 10%, there's 2%. No, you'll tell me there could always be miracles. Okay, Sheva ben Bichri could have had a miracle too. But we don't make halachic decisions based on miracles. Right? So if al derech hateva, naturally, a person has no chance, according to Rashi, that's the prerequisite of having any discussion. It makes sense that other people would agree with that, but who's to say if a doctor said a person, let's say the case was identical to the one we began with, but the doctor said that the one baby has a 95% chance of dying anyway, but there's a 5% chance. So for Rashi, that would clearly have made a difference. Would that make a difference for the Rambam or others? It's hard to know. Now again, in the particular case in question, the doctors, to the best of their human ability, said it's a 100% chance. So you didn't meet the Rashi threshold evenly. Even. But not necessarily would that always, of course, be the case. Now, we know how the Rambam paskins. What about in Shulchan Aruch? Is this discussed? So take a look in source number 4. We have the Ramah. In case anyone was worried, it was an Ashkenazic family in Lakewood. So what does the Ramah have to say for this, right? What is the Ramah? All of a sudden, everyone's going to say, you know, you thought Kidnios was the best reason to be Sephardic, right? Anyway, I don't know what is happening here. I'm sorry about that. Anyway, so says the Ramah in source number 4, you're not allowed to give a person over. Ela im kein yichduhu va'amru tnu lanu ish ploni, etc. Okay, who's that? So the first thing the Rama says, you can only give the person over if he's been identified. Oh, that's Rabbi Yochanan. But then he continues, yesh omrim, a second opinion, da'afilu b'chihai gavna, even if they identified somebody, ein lemosra elim kein, chayiv misa kasheva ben bichri. In essence, the Rama doesn't help us. I don't know what to say other than that he doesn't help us. One second. I'll take your question in the back in 1 second. But he doesn't really help us. He says it, and that's that. Now, the Taz in source number 5 says, listen, you know, we can't just live with this paralysis by analysis of the Rama. We need to say something. So the Taz says in number 5, Ul inyan halacha yeshon olivso ken kiresh lakish. Lo yimsru elim ken chayiv misa sheva ben bichri. Kedeya habeins shehev yarama. You know, that's, he quotes his, you see that on the last thing. This is just a cute biographical note. The Taz will often quote Mem Vav Ches. What is Mem Vav Ches abbreviation? Anyone know what that is? Mori Chami, which is my father-in-law. His father-in-law was the Bach, Rav Yoel Sirkis, who was known as the Bach, a great posek, or the commentary on the tour. But you can imagine, you know, insert joke here, that, you know, the Taz, who was one of the greatest rabbis of his generation, coming in the generation after his father-in-law was one of the greatest rabbis of his generation, he's often quoting his father, and he, you know, it's like the son-in-law's revenge, because here he's agreeing with his father-in-law, but very often he disagrees. So if he had a bad, you know, and I believe the story goes that for the first number of years of their marriage, the Bach, I'm not sure what his source of income was, I don't know enough of his biography, but he was supporting the Taz, the son-in-law, in learning. He was, well, in other places they call it the Shver. So, you know, once you're being supported by the father-in-law, he has certain license with you. So you can imagine all the frustration that builds up in the supported son-in-law. The Taz had an outlet. He could write a commentary in Shulchan Aruch and show how smarter he was than his father-in-law. But anyway, in this particular case, you have none of that mischief. They happen to agree. And they both say that, listen, the Ramah doesn't really give us much. Although you could add, and this is a methodological point in general, often the assumption is, well, if there's two opinions of the Ramah, maybe the second one is the more main one. Whether that's what the Ramah means or not, I don't know, but the Taz certainly assumes that. What I could tell you is as follows. We don't have these cases all the time, Baruch Hashem, and often, to use a Holocaust analogy or example, often if we would have them, is not exactly a chance to ask a Shaila. But this particular case was one, the Siamese twin case. And in essence, to the extent that Po Fasham in history we've had such Shilas, given the equivocation of the Ramah, there's no clear psak. And again, if this was a Hilchos Kiddush or Halakas Nero Shila, you know, okay, you can assume like this or like that. But here we're talking about literally life and death. The general assumption of Morei Hara, of Poskim, has been they would not allow it unless we would assume that everyone would agree. Meaning, whether it's with Rav Chanan or Reish Lakish, or even Rashi with his higher standard. And even let's stipulate that the Rambam didn't say it's 100%, so maybe it's not. Maybe in the Rambam's mind, even if the person could have escaped. But you don't have to assume that. The bottom line is you're risking the whole city. The Goyim or Lahavdil Yoav wants this guy. Go find him. Don't let him escape. Maybe according to the Rambam, that would be enough if the person's really deserving of death. Whereas Rashi said, no, if the guy could escape. So Rashi, let's just put this way. Reish Lakish is much more strict than Rabbi Yochanan. And Rashi is the strictest version of Reish Lakish. So can we get everyone to agree? If we can, we would allow the case to go forward. And if not, then, you know, this is, you know, certain poskim, I think I've spoken about this in the past, it's worth it of a 1 minute digression. Certain poskim, even on the most simple of shilas, want to cover every base. Not recommended to use such people as poskim, no matter how much they know. But there are certain people like this, they mean well, but they're always nervous. How could I be going against so-and-so in Shemayim? So-and-so is going to be against me, whatever the case may be. Sincere. And, you know, if you want to live life that way, tavo alecha bracha, but I don't think one has to. Let's just put it that way. But there are major shilas, you know, really life-altering shilas, in which even the most responsible posek is going to be a little bit more conservative and say, you know what, I'll give you just an example. At least lechachila, aguna. I don't mean modern-day aguna, as tragic that. I mean like the classical aguna. The husband goes off to war and he never comes back. Right? Or what we had 11 years ago in the World Trade Center. I was learning in the Kollel in YU at the time, coincidentally, and of course you see there is no coincidence, we had just started, right? It was before Rosh Hashanah. It was just Elul Zman. We just started New Year in Yeshiva, and the Kollel that I was in was learning the end of Masechet Yevamos, which discusses Aguna. It was a particular section of Gemara that, as far as I know, in at least 40 years, if not longer, maybe ever, YU had never learned, not in any single Kollel. They learned Yevamos, another part of Yevamos, but this part of Yevamos we were doing. And what is the second unbelievable coincidence? In the end, the Dayanim who were involved in Paskening, almost, not all, but almost every one of the Shilas that really came out of that, the number two Dayan, if you will, of that whole thing, was the head of our Kollel, Rabbi Willig. The RCA Bezdin Paskened, I think, either 7 or 9 of the Aguna Shilas that came out of the World Trade Center. There was a Hasidish Dayan who did one, Ravaj Yosef did another, and I think all the other ones went to the RCA Bezdin, of which Rabbi Willig is the Skanav Bezdin. So we were literally with him the whole year on the front lines as they went through this process of investigating, etc. And in the end, the Kollel Journal, of which I published in, I didn't edit it that year, but I had edited the one before that, which I published in, that was where the original tshuvas matering all of those women to remarry are all in the Kol Tzvi, the Kollel Journal of YU, because that's what we were learning that year. And it was an amazing, amazing experience. Tragic, obviously, but an amazing experience to end up being part of that halachic history. So there, all things being equal, we're talking about allowing a married woman, an eshes ish, to remarry without a get, you know, without definitive evidence that her husband died. So you all know what the halachic consequences of getting that wrong are. So on the one hand, there are certain leniencies that we allow because we have rachamonis on the woman. On the other hand, there are tremendous chumras that have been put in place from the time of the Gemara, of real, real high thresholds that have to be overcome to allow a married woman to remarry without any definitive evidence or a get. So that's an example where it would be hard. Let's assume, I'm just giving a simplest example. Let's say about a certain case where Moshe Feinstein said yes and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said no. So if you ask me a Hilchos Kiddush question, a Neiros, even a Hilchos Nida question maybe. So I would say, you know, in such and such a case, you can rely on so-and-so to be lenient. But all things being equal, typically, you do not want a Matir Naguna knowing that Moshe Feinstein would have said, that's Eshes Ish. Or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach would have said, that's a Chi of Misa. You know, you try to, this is what the where the real sweat equity comes in, where you have to schwitz, to be able to have enough evidence, enough argumentation, enough points, so that you can check off this all the major poskim that they would all agree with you. Moreover, there's a tradition, for example, in Aguna, that no matter how big a tzaddik and a gadol you are, you don't just write your tshuva matzuring the woman to get married and say Shalom Yisrael. There's a tradition going back hundreds of years that then after you've done that, if you're the primary bezdin or the primary posik, you then go around with all humility, because this is what's necessary for the woman, to as many gedolim as possible and get them to sign off as well. And that's in fact what happened. So other poskim from Eretz Yisrael in particular who were not involved in the deliberations, they then got the whole written record and were able to sign off. We also agree, because you want to do once you're matzuring, you want to do everything possible. So that was not literally life and death, but it was halachically all stakes, the highest stakes possible. Here we have not only a halachically high stakes, we have literally life and death. And even though it's very rare to have such a shiloh, I can tell you the general assumption is we would not necessarily want to have to matir such a case unless we would feel like everyone would agree. To say, well, this is, we were allowed to kill this baby according to the Rambam. Okay, but Rashi might have thought we're murderers. Hey, no one, including Moshe Feinstein, would want to go to sleep like that. So how? Let's plug it in. If this was the argument being used, could we compare our two cases to the case of the siege? On the one, you could say, well, Sheva ben Bichri, or the person who's being designated, was going to die anyway. This baby, the second one, the one who had only the two-chamber heart who was dying, was going to die anyway. And again, we, as far as we know, medical evidence, it's 100% this person has no choice, no chance. And in fact, the written record is that Moshe Feinstein asked that question many times. Are you sure that, as it's not the doctors choosing, let's flip a coin, do we want A or B? The only medical decision was to save one because the other one had no choice. And apparently this was something that was very much under Moshe Feinstein's, no chance, under Moshe's mind. So let's think about that for a second. How, let's play this out. Would this be allowed or not allowed? So in fact, this is the suggestion, using this analogy, this is the suggestion, at least one suggestion, that Rav Tendler himself suggested many years later in an article. Take a look at number 6. And he says as follows. He says, Rav Moshe says, if you hold like the one opinion, which is like Reb Yochanan, as long as the person is specified. So here, it's not a non-Jew specifying, but fate has specified that this baby is going to die anyway. So according to Reb Yochanan, it should be fine. But the Rambam Paskins like Reish Lakish. So says Rabbi Tendler as follows. In the analysis of the case in source number 6, even the requirement of Maimonides, all should be allowed according to the opinion of Rav Moshe. Why? Baby A could not live no matter what the surgical plan was followed. And here is the huge leap, which you'll tell me if you buy it or not. Although there was no ruling of a Beit Din that she was guilty of any sin and therefore would be subjected to punishment like Sheva ben Bichri, Hashem himself issued such a ruling. There was an edict from heaven that the child could not live. Nobody could help this child. Even if all the organs were placed in her body, she could not survive. Therefore, baby A should be classified as if she were Sheva ben Bichri, for whom there was no hope, and the destiny was already inscribed by Hashem himself. The decision to sacrifice her is one that would have had the approval of both Rashi and the Rambam. In essence, what he's saying, and this is clearly a leap, and either you agree, you buy it, or you don't, but he says, Rashi said 100%. Okay, but the doctors are telling us 100%. But what about this? How do we know that Reish Lakish does not have to be specified? Like, she has to be deserving of death. So Rav Tendler suggests that what Rav Moshe had understood was it doesn't just mean a moral culpability. Chai of Misa, you know, you drove on Shabbos, you were a murderer, you blasphemed, you were a traitor. It doesn't have to be a moral culpability. It means that you have been, in essence, given no hope, that this is it. There's nothing else that can be done. In essence, He basically makes this like equivalent to Rashi, in essence. And there, and therefore, again, what does deserving mean? Right, right. So therefore, yeah, so he suggests that maybe this was Rav Moshe's rationale. Again, and you see in Rav Teller something that I was, you know, I had that digression for a few minutes about Aguna. The reason I gave you that digression was to give us an example. You see here, it was not enough for Rav Teller just to say Rav Moshe did it because it worked according to him and him. It had to be good according to everyone, says Rav Teller, or else Rav Moshe wouldn't have done it. And this is how he kvetches. Now, I have to tell you, Mei Rosh, I'll tell you right now, I am not convinced.
Maybe the baby is deserving of that. Maybe it's
a being. We're going to get to that. We're going to get to that. That is not the first argument. We have not mentioned the word Rodef yet, but we will in a minute. The first model, the first argument has nothing to do with Rodef. Nothing to do with Rodef. It has to do with this other model in Halacha of the besieged city. And in that case, it says maybe that's Rav Moshe's model. But clearly, again, there's a certain logic to it, but clearly the underside, the weakest link in this chain is this deserving part. Rav Moshe basically puts quotes, Rav Teller puts quotes on the deserving.
Maybe the word deserving is not the right word to
you. Decree. Okay, according to Rav Teller, 100%. Correct. Okay, that's the word, again, that just...
Not the death part, yes, but not deserving.
Again, so how would you... why did we get this word? Because the Gemara said Chayev Misa. Okay, good. Excellent. I love that. Excellent. So I'm going to change this.
This is unbelievable.
I have never had this ever. I'm not that popular. I am. No, I. Each time somebody calls, I figure there's only going to be one phone call because no one ever calls.
Same person 15 times.
Well, maybe it's an emergency.
Nothing more than teaching Torah.
But what about the fact that no matter...
One second. This is, I like this very much. I was going to say, or I said, there's like there's deserving in quotes. But I like this better. I like this better. Excellent. So if you translate it as sentenced to death, so then you could say this baby who had the two chambers was in essence sentenced to death. Very good. I got to move on or we're not going to cover enough ground. That's all model number one. Again, it's a hypothesis. It's a speculation. Maybe it's good. Maybe it's not. One of the people who didn't like this at all was Rabbi Bleich. Rabbi J. David Bleich, who is, of course, some of you I'm sure know the name, a great, great posek and halachic genius, and in particular is also one of the world experts in medical ethics, legal ethics, everything ethics. Rabbi Bleich did not like this at all. For the simple reason, I could reduce his whole article to one thing. He translated it as deserving. In other words, again, to be fair to Rabbi Bleich, that's how everyone has translated this Gemara for 1,000 years. That is the common understanding of Chayev Misa. Sheva ben Michri deserved to die because he rebelled against the king. When you read the Gemara, if you'd never read Rabbi Tendler's article, that's probably how you would translate it also. So Rabbi Tendler has this move, which Rabbi Bleich does not buy. Okay, that's a machlokas. Maybe yes, maybe no. That's one machlokas. That's one possibility. Let's look at the second one, which is clearly the one which was the favorite of the crowd, which is since the beginnings, people have suggested maybe it's Rodef, maybe it's a pregnant mother. So sure enough, that's the second possible argument in source number 7. A second model, also suggested by Rabbi Tendler and out of his family, they suggested another possibility. The Mishnah, you've seen this. This is a review of the sources we did on our abortion shiur. The Mishnah in Olo says in source number 7 that if a woman is pregnant and all of a sudden some catastrophe happens and the doctors have to choose to sacrifice the baby to save her life, or if not, risk both, you are allowed to do that. You are allowed to do that. However, of course, that doesn't get us all the way home, because the Mishnah in the next breath says once the baby is born alive, i.e. head or majority out, then you're not allowed to choose. Why not? Al yimsru nefesh achal b'zero. We don't play God. We don't get to pick. So the question is, how helpful or not will this particular case model be? In source number 8, again, a Gemara we saw back from our abortion shiurim, we had the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin added a factor which made the Mishnah more common. Again, the Mishnah never used the word Rodef, but the Gemara did. But the Gemara said, usually Rodef means I'm running after you to shoot you so you or someone else can shoot me. So why don't we say even after the baby's head has come out, but the baby's a Rodef? Yes, the baby's alive. But it's not two innocent people in a park. The baby is being Rodef, its mother. Why don't we use that argument? That's not my question. That was the Gemara's question. So the Gemara says on the last line, source number 8, Amai Rodefu, kill the baby even when the head's come out. It's the same thing as Bar. Now the baby's alive. Who said we can't kill living people to save other people? We do it all the time. That's called rodef. If you're pursuing someone else. So the Gemara answers, no. Shani hasam demishmaya karat filei. You're blaming the baby here? The baby's culpable? The baby didn't do anything. Min shamaya. This is from shamayim. The baby is not active participant. I mean, well, I don't know what the word. The baby's not consciously doing this. It's coming min shamayim. If a person is trying to threaten you, so they made that decision, they put themselves in harm's way by threatening you. But when Shamayim put this baby in harm's way by, in essence, rigging it so that this baby is now threatening the life of its mother, Shamayim did that. We don't give the child the status of a rodef in that case. That is the Gemara's... Now, so therefore, well, why is it allowed then before the baby? If it's min Shamayim, so why do we allow you to kill... What? Which stage? Oh, so if that's the question, so if the Gemara is taking Rodef off of the table, so then how is it that we're even allowed, even in the 6th month or whatever, how are we allowed to do that either? So Rashi says, again, you'll check your notes from our abortion shear. I didn't put it on the sheet. I don't believe it. Rashi says, because until the baby is born, it does not have full Kedusha Sachayim. In the non-Jewish world, we talk about life and non-life. We have a middle stage, says Rashi, called potential life, which has a certain level of kedusha. You can't wantonly abort such a child. That's an avera. You assume most poskim, again, check your notes from the abortion lecture, are probably an avera d'oraisa. But, says Rashi, it's not the same as a living person. It's a potential life. And therefore, when you have a zero-sum game, a threat between the potential life of the fetus, of the baby, and the full life, the real life of the mother, says Rashi, that's when you can... But, says Rashi, and Rashi works out beautifully, once the baby has become born and the baby him or herself is a full life, so then the only way you could have picked or choose one or the other is if you could have the rodef. And the Gemara says, no, you don't have rodef. Now, one last step before we can get to our case of the Siamese twins, and that is number 9, the Rambam. The Rambam, everything I told you just in the last 2 minutes is totally, I hope, clear, but very simple and straightforward in terms of the literature. The Rambam threw a monkey wrench. Again, this is all stuff we did in the abortion lecture, but we're reviewing now. The Rambam threw a monkey wrench. Because even though the Gemara only raised the possibility of rodef for the case of when the baby's head's already out, and then the Gemara rejected it, the Rambam somehow ignores the Gemara and uses the model of rodef. What does the Rambam say in source number 9? After telling you that in general there's a halacha called rodef and you can kill the person even if you're a third party, let alone if you're the intended victim, then says the Rambam, and if a woman is having difficulty giving birth and her life is at risk and the head is not yet out, the majority of the body is not yet out, in that case, what's the halacha? You abort the baby to save the mother. Mipnei, third line, shehu karodef achareha laharga. The Rambam pulled a double move. The Rambam applies the rule of rodef, which anyway seems to go against the Gemara, because the Gemara said it's not the baby's fault, it's Hashem's fault. Gemara said that, right? That's not a heretical statement, that's the Gemara said it. And number 2, even when the Gemara entertained it, before it rejected it, the Gemara was talking about the case when the head was out. The Rambam only mentions rodef about the case before the baby's been born at all, and he applies rodef even though the Gemara rejected it. Now, how is that possible? We did not spend too much time answering that a few weeks ago in our abortion share. But I can say without a doubt, you could fill up at least one bookcase, or at least one shelf in a bookcase, for sure, just with the ink that has been spilled over the centuries trying to explain this Rambam. This is one of these really pull-your-hair-out Rambams. How could he do it? It's a double contradiction to the Gemara. Okay, this is not a shear now to explain that Rambam. But we have the Rambam on the books. The Rambam on the books does tell us that sometimes we have a concept of rodef, and we are allowed to choose, and therefore, even in such a case, to have one life instead of the other. And therefore, as a second possible rationale, maybe we can apply it. Why? Because Rav Tendler, here in source number 10, in his second rationale, he does think that he has an answer for explaining not only the Rambam, but then applying it to Siamese twins. I'm going to paraphrase it. It's easy for you to look at if you want to yourself. But Rav Tendler says, and again, I'm not reading it word for word, Rav Tendler says, you know what the difference is? You know what's the essential? Come on. The Gemara did say you can't blame the child. So So it's telling, yeah, the Rambam can't ignore that. It's in the Gemara. So what must the Rambam be getting at? That it has to do with dependency. When you have two people walking down the street, one chasing the other, so they're two independent people, fine. And then the usual rules of road diff apply. But in the case of a fetus, it's not two equals. One, the fetus, is totally dependent on the mother for its life. And therefore, says Rav Tendler, in such a case, the fetus, the dependent one, does not have an equal claim to life. Because after all, its whole life anyway is dependent on the mother. It has some claim to life. Again, we wouldn't carelessly abort the child. But when we're forced to choose, it's not a question of culpability. Min HaShamayim that came from. But it's still relevant, because Rodev still allows us to choose if we can break the tie. How do we break the tie? Well, it's not that the one person's a bad. There's no mugger here. There's no terrorist here, Chas v'Shalom. We have an innocent child. Innocent. Pure as snow. But still does not have the same claim to life because of the dependency. That's the key line here. If you see the second part of the underline in Rav Tendler, I'll just read the one line. Surely it is the fetal status of dependency on the mother that justifies the sacrifice of fetal life to save the maternal life. Once the baby's head comes out, once the baby is born, then it's not dependent on the mother anymore. Then it's already breathing on its own. Then it's living on its own. Then it's considered independent halakhically. As long as the baby's dependent, he says that is ultimately why the mother's always given precedence over the baby. Well, once you use that, again, that word, or whatever Hebrew or Aramaic translation you would want to give, that is a word that was introduced by Rav Tendler. In other words, if you would read the laws of Rodev or have an abortion shear without this article from Rav Tendler, no one else mentions this idea of dependency to explain the Rambam. Now, Rav Tendler thinks it's obvious that he's correct. That's his prerogative to think that he's correct. But it's not an obvious point. Just like he change the translation of deserving to sentenced, which may be correct, maybe not, but there was a certain chiddush in that. His second argument is a different chiddush, which is that maybe the underlying heter for this famous halacha, which everybody knows, that you can sacrifice the fetus in order to save the mother, maybe the issue is dependency. Now, why is that important? It's important because now we have a way of applying the laws of Rodef and abortion to the case of the Siamese twins, because in this particular case, the one baby with the two-chamber heart clearly couldn't live on her own. The only way she was living the first month of her life was she's dependent on the strength, the circulation, etc., which is primarily being driven by the first one. And therefore, says Rav Tendler, that would be sufficient in order to qualify for the Din Rodev. It was interesting, after the surgery, even though I said Rav Moshe Feinstein never gave any report, the doctors, there was a big press conference in the hospital, and there was a huge article, which you could still probably find online, a huge article, pages, in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Because you can imagine, this is an interesting story for everybody. You know, so it was like one of the only times you had a full expose on religion, and it didn't make us look bad. It's a very fascinating case, obviously. So there, the doctors used an analogy. I think they claimed they heard it from Moshe Feinstein. I don't know how accurate it is or not, but just to make the point further, they gave the analogy of somebody who jumps out, two people who jump out of a plane. One person's parachute opens, and the other one didn't. So as the person whose parachute never didn't open is screaming down, they grab onto the leg of the other one. I'm aware, but that's too tragic and too soon to even make a reference to. So this is the analogy. You can find this from the 30 plus years ago in the Philadelphia Inquirer. They use this analogy in the name of Rav Moshe Feinstein. So the question was, the moral question was, could the one who had the parachute, could he kick off to his death the one below? And the answer presumably is yes, because the one who's hanging on to his leg is in essence a rodent, not a bad person, but in essence a rodent. Because at this point, even though they're both alive, clearly the only reason that the guy hanging on is alive is he's dependent on the first guy. And once you have an issue of dependency, then even if you don't have an issue of guilt or culpability, but once you have dependency, then you do not have any more two equal claims to life, and then Rodef can kick in. That was Rav Tendler's second argument, which Rabbi Bleich didn't like. Why does Rabbi Bleich not like this? It's based on source number 11, Rabbi Akiva Eger. Great, great Rabbi Akiva Eger says the following, in general, when it comes to the laws of road rage. So I said before, it's not just the intended victim who can save him or herself by turning around and shooting first. Let's say you're the innocent bystander, you're the third party, and you see they're running down Emek Rephaim, and, oh, I'm going to kill you, and you happen to have a gun, so you take the gun out, who do you kill? How do you know which one to kill? Let's say instead of it's one person running after the old lady with the pocketbook, let's say it's two guys shooting at each other. Who's the rodif and who's the nirdaf? Says Rabbi Kiv Eger that they can each try to defend themselves. Okay, they're in the game, so to speak. But you, the third party, says Rabbi Kiv Eger in source number 11, you can only be involved when it's clear that there's a rodif and a nirdaf. But in this case, kevin de kol echad legabe chaveiro lo'ayedin nirdaf, l'haya rishay l'hargo. Says Rabbi Kiv Eger, if they're all trying to kill each other, so how can you give one the status of nirdaf, victim, to save? You can't get involved. So says Rabbi Bleich, he feels that despite the fact that clearly the prognoses were not equal for the two, clearly one baby was in worse shape than the other, but in the end, any one of the day that you're going to do that surgery, any one of the babies could live if they had the full good heart. Not long term. But the point is, he says, in essence, what's creating the exigent circumstances? In fact, you have two bodies trying to drain life from one heart, which is insufficient for both. But in theory, couldn't that one heart support either one of them?
Obviously.
In theory,
one was definitely
one was definitely die eventually, but not because of the heart. If they had done what they had said was, if we do the surgery to save the baby with the two, we put the holes, it will eventually die. There's no hope for a long-term recovery. But not, they weren't saying that the baby was going to die that day. Yeah, not today. So really, says Rabbi Black, he thinks that in this case, they're both rodef after each other. They both want the heart. And again, this is something which you know, but I remind you of, and it's important to know because it's really profound. We don't scoff at a week or 2 weeks or a month. Again, with a baby sitting in an ICU, it's a little bit harder, maybe it's harder for some people to sympathize. But we mentioned this a few weeks ago in our shiur about high-risk medical procedures. I have a person who's given 6 months to live. On the one hand, it's a horrible diagnosis. On the other hand, those 6 months can be a huge bracha on a ben arm l'chavero level and on a ben arm l'makom level. And we believe every minute of life has unlimited sanctity. So the fact that this baby will eventually die, but right now the baby could have survived surgery just as well as the other one. So he thinks that Rabbi Bleich, that they're both rodef each other, and because of that, Rabbi Bleich says, you have this problem of Rabbi Kibaker, when there's two people being rodef each other, so let the two babies fight it out. Figuratively, obviously. But we as the third party, the doctors can't come in. So what does Rabbi Bleich say? He doesn't like anything Rabbi Teller says. So what did he say? So Rabbi Bleich wrote an article in Tradition, Volume 31, in which he proposed his own suggestion. Now, he has one disadvantage. I don't think even according to Rabbi Bleich's telling, he was involved in the negotiations in the Lower East Side. See, he's not claiming to know firsthand. On the other hand, Rabbi Bleich does something ingenious. Rabbi Bleich explains Rav Moshe based on a printed tshuva that Rav Moshe had about a different topic. So obviously, if you can, it's not just pulling something out of a wind. If you can say, we already know Rav Moshe believed in a certain argument because he used it in a different tshuva, which we do have printed, maybe we can apply that to this case. And that's Rabbi Bleich's move, if you will, in the last few sources. If you look at source number 12, this is the issue of the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, who's discussing, again, the problem I alluded to before, which is, how does the Rambam understand abortion? Right? It's the ultimate catch-22. If the baby is a rodef, then the baby should be a rodef even after its head comes out. And if the Gemara says that the baby after its head comes out can't be a rodef, because it's really Hashem who's deciding, then how can the Rambam say the baby's a rodef before the head comes out? Right? That's the major problem with source number 9. The problem, as I said, has been books and books and books worth of ink spilled to try to solve that. So Rabbi Tamler himself said, what's the answer? Dependency. In utero, the baby is dependent. And now, once the baby's head comes out, it's no longer is dependent. But Rav Moshe Feinstein, in source number 12, actually himself gave a different explanation to that question. But here's the thing. This is here's the subtlety which you have to hold on to now. I'm glad everyone ate already today, so other than me. But you're all, you know, you ate your Wheaties, so you're mentally sharp, because this is not easy. I know that. But I hope it's been worthwhile, but I know it's not easy. Says Rav Moshe in source number 12, in essence, we've been discussing two models. The siege city And then the Rodef abortion case. Rodef on another model. Here Rav Moshe does something very clever. He combines them. He says, who said that Rodef isn't part of the siege case? You were saying to me, Rodef. And I said, no, we didn't say Rodef yet. We're talking about the siege. Well, in my own defense, that's because that's how that case is traditionally understood, as a separate model, not connected to Rodef. But Rav Moshe says, like you, in this tshuva, Rav Moshe is explaining it's an abortion shiloh. It's not a Siamese twins shiloh. But here he says, in this case, don't you say that they're both Rodfim? Sheshnehem Rodfim. What do you mean they're both Rodfim? This is Rav Moshe's chiddush. He says that the city and Sheva ben Bichri rode Rodef each other. What do you mean? They're threatening to turn him over to Yoav. So they're putting his life at risk. The fact that he walked into their city put them at risk. So they're both Rodef each other. So, how are you allowed to get involved? Didn't Rabbi Kiva Eger say then when you have Rodef each other, you can get involved? So he explains, in Baruch, second line, Shiyamusu kulam ka'uvta the Sheva ben Bichri. If it's clear that otherwise everyone will die, La'achar eza sha'ot v'yamim, Shitvasena Yov, because Yov eventually is going to find him. Nim sashem rotfin oso rakal chayesha. Who Rodef osam b'chal chayim. Rav Moshe introduces, he uses a model from Rodef to explain the siege. And says, you know what, maybe there's another way. And we usually think, which is generally the case, that each person involved has an absolute right to life. How do you break that logjam? So Rabbi Tendler had his dependency model. Or his other, Rav Moshe has a new model here in this tshuva. He says, it depends on how much life, in essence, are you taking away. And if you remember from our shiur 2 weeks ago about high-risk medical procedures, we have two terms in halakha. What were those terms? Well, you guys are good. This is like an honors class, I think.
Definitely.
Everyone could come to the spring, but only the superstars come to the summer class. Okay. We have chaye sha'a and chaye olam. Now, we mentioned again, Chaye Olam. Olam, we translated, since I hate to break it to you, no one lives forever. Chaye Olam does not mean you live forever. Chaye Olam means exactly, as far as we know, you have a normal life expectancy. Chaye Shah means the clock is already ticking, we know you're on borrowed time. We discussed, does that mean within a year, more than a year, Rav Kook said, as long as the machla already started? We discussed that 2 weeks ago. So said Rav Moshe, whenever you have two roads fit, so Rabbi Kiva Eger, until now, for 250 years in halakhic history, Rabbi Kiva Eger had a big red sign, stop. Two rotfim, third party can't get involved. That was Rabbi Bleich's own criticism of Rabbi Tendler. But he says, no, but we have a new chiddush of our motion. Our motion says, you know how we can break that tie? What if, even though there's two being rotef each other, but let's say they're each threatening to take away, not equal, but one is taking to take away more than the other. Right? There's two bank robbers, but if one could take $1 million out of the bank, and the other one could take $5 million. They're not the same. So here also, yes, they're both being rodef each other. But one is only threatening Chaye Shah, and the other is threatening Chaye Olam. Now, you're not allowed to threaten anybody. But if we see a situation with these two threats against each other, then, says Rav Moshe, we are allowed to be involved. Even though Rabbi Kiva Eger has stopped halakhic history from the 18th century on and said, no, whenever there are two rodefim, you don't get involved, says Rav Moshe Feinstein, that's when they only have equal threats. They're equal ganavim of life, if you will. But when there's a dip. So he says, what's going on here? In the case of Sheva ben Bichri. Either Sheva ben Bichri will, I don't remember this, if this is exactly correct, but let's, Bonagid, that Yoav said, I'll give you 3 days. So how much life does Sheva ben Bichri have?
3 days.
He has Chayesha, which is called? Chayesha. Either, no, that doesn't mean you get to murder someone because he only has 3 days to live. We know that. But if we have to be, you know, cold and calculated about it, what are we taking, if they give over Sheva ben Bichri today, what are we taking from him? What do we rob from him? Chaye Shah, 3 days. But by him staying in the city, by him coming into the city to begin with, what did he threaten everyone else in the city with? They're Chayolim. Now, what does that mean? One person's going to Nebuch drop dead in a heart attack that he doesn't even know he's about to have in 2 days, and one person's going to live till 98. But that's called Chayolim. Exactly, that's all called Chayolim. That's normal life expectancy. Said Rav Moshe, you know why it was mutter to give over Sheva ben Bichri? The din of Rodef. Aye, but how can you use Rodef? Rav Moshe asks on himself rhetorically. Isn't this a tie? Aren't they both being Rodef each other? Said Rav Moshe, yes, but you could still pick.
How do we get to know who to pick? Because he was threatening, not more people. We don't go by more people. That goes back to the first source of today. We don't look at people, numbers, 100 people versus one person. Every person has unlimited Kedusha Sachayim. But he was threatening Chai Olam. He was threatening their normal life expectancy. They were only threatening his by giving him over his Chai Isha. And that, says Rav Moshe Feinstein, a Chiddush Atzum, from the time of the Gemara, right, the Talmud Yerushalmi, until the 20th century, until Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote this tshuva, no one had ever made that argument. Rav Moshe Feinstein has this unbelievable creative Chiddush. That's how he goes back to read source number one we began today with. So you'll say, okay, if we're learning about siege cities, that's a great Chiddush. Says Rav Bleich, now, if with this understanding, now we can apply it to the Siamese twins. Why? And now we have a right to do what a lot of you wanted to do the whole year, but I wasn't letting you. But now I'm going to give you a release. Now you can apply, says Rabbi Bleich, the prognosis of the doctors. Because the fact that this baby will die anyway. So I said, what does it matter? The baby's not going to die today. It does matter now. Because this baby only has Chayesha. So yes, it's true, they're both being rote for each other. Yes, you could argue, theoretically, that they both have, in that sense, maybe they both have a legitimate claim to the heart. They both have a legitimate claim to be on that side of the surgery, not the side you don't want to be on. But, says Rabbi Bleich, you know what breaks the tie? Rav Moshe Feinstein's own chiddush that he gave years earlier about abortion. He was talking about an abortion case there. He used this lumdus. But now we can apply it here. When you have two people being rote for each other, not a mom and a fetus, but two beautiful, yummy, delicious, holy Jewish girls in a hospital bed in Lakewood, in down Philadelphia. But they're not having the same equal claim to life. One has a Chai Isha claim. The other has a Chai Olam. In that case, says Rabbi Bleich, according to Ramosha's own logic, that will legitimate choosing the one who has Chai Olam, a chance of Chai Olam, and not the one who, at best, would only have Chai Isha. Ladies, I want to finish with 3 points. 3 points. Number one. Don't read it. Let me read it for you. I'm kidding. Number one. This was a complicated, confusing topic. That partially by design. Because you should realize it ain't always easy. Number one. Number two is when we don't have Rav Moshe Feinstein even telling us. If you, you could find holes, I think, to me clearly, in all three of these models. Some of you might be convinced by one, two, or all three of them, but you could easily poke holes in all three of them. And the answer is, you know what? We can't know 100%. We don't know, and even Rav Moshe Feinstein said it, he was Rav Moshe Feinstein, not Moshe Rabbeinu. You could argue on him anyway. But clearly there's an interest, and I think a very admirable one, to defend this psak. On halakhic grounds, on human interest grounds, and you see people of great intellectual gifts and Torah knowledge and integrity, hopefully, struggling. But you add the fact that it's such a complicated shiloh with a complicated psak and no written record, this is, in essence, in case you were wondering what would happen in such a case, this is what happens. That's what you get. Number one. Number two. So what actually happened? Yeah. The answer, as I said, was that the surgery was successful. And unfortunately, again, the one baby died that day. The other baby had a successful surgery. But 47 days later, from complications indirect, not directly with the surgery, indirectly, the baby died. You know why the baby died? Because this is before we had the sensitivity that we now have about blood. And the baby contracted, according to one version that I read, hepatitis infection from the blood. Now, not every article that I read mentioned that particular point, so I'm only telling you what I read in one place. One way or the other, this is for sure, a little over a month, about almost a month and a half later, obviously somewhat related, but indirectly related to surgery. The surgery, as a surgery, amazingly was successful, but nebuch for this family, a month and a half later, the baby died. But I want to add my third and last point to end on a more positive note, and that's the story Rabbi Tendler tells in number 14, which is says a lot about Rav Moshe Feinstein, but I have to admit, it says even more about Dr. Siav Rekup. Again, if you've read it, you understand, but imagine,
There was a 2 or 3 weeks where they were waiting for Moshe Feinstein to give his answer. But meanwhile, they had all of these big, big geniuses and these big gedolei doctors sitting on call, hanging around Philadelphia Children's Hospital, waiting for the call. And apparently, this is what happened. They started getting antsy and said, no, Dr. Koop, well, I'm busy, I have a life, I have a practice, you know, I'm the head of such and such, what's going to be? To which Rav Koop, Dr. Koop, I said Rav Koop, he was a Rav in this regard, the Rebbe Rav Sieverit. So he said, again, as you read here, this, you know, something we have to be honest, sometimes we don't know. I don't know and you don't know. But the rabbi in the Lower East Side, when he tells me, then we'll all know. Sometimes the Munas Chachamim we have to learn from Sieverit Koop. Yeah. All right. Have a good day.